I've been wanting to talk to this woman for a long time because I always thought that the bite-sized way that she would be interviewed would make her boring when it felt like she had more depth, but it couldn't be captured by bite-sized interviews in the racing world. Danica Patrick has been a bit of a pioneer in terms of bringing strength and speed from women to racing. You can listen to her Danica's Pretty Intense podcast, wherever you get your podcast. This Thursday's guest is Toni Kanaan, but I wanted to talk to her about who she is and how she is, who she is, and her relationship with Aaron Rodgers, and just tackle some stuff with Danica Patrick that is different from what you're used to hearing from her about racing. We'll get to that in a second, but first, here's Mike to tell you about this week's sponsor.
Dan, South Beach Sessions this week is brought to us by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter has been with us since day one of South Beach Sessions. We can't thank them enough. As you know, audience, hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura COO Dylan Maskowitz needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified candidates. So you know what he did? He switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so it could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is so effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach, people. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire.
All right, I think you're going to enjoy this. We're going to get into the mind here of Danica Patrick in a way I don't think you've heard her before. Joined now by a pioneer, Danica Patrick. You know that name. You associate it with fast. Listen and download Danica's Pretty Intense podcast, wherever it is you get your podcasts. This Thursday's guest is Toni Kanaan. Danica, I appreciate you spending the time with us. We had your boyfriend Aaron Rodgers on last week, and he was saying how competitive you were. And so I just want to get at the roots of how it is that you became that kind of competitive, because he was saying that he stays out of it because you're just more competitive than he is.
I don't know. He's pretty competitive too, but I mean, it's just something that's always been inside me since I was a little kid. I mean, if I was playing cards, I wanted to win, and I would go over this fun little slightly competitive thing that I would do with my sister, where if the phone would ring, I would count down from 3, 2, 1, and we'd race to go get the phone, but I never wanted to actually get it, so I just basically duped her into going to get the phone, so I just sit on the couch, but I guess that's somewhat competitive, but I wanted not having to go get it. But I think there's always that question of nurture versus nature and how much of it is just in you and how much of it is taught, but I'm going to bet there's probably a fair amount of both.
Where do you fall on that one? Like, what kind of disciplinarians were your parents, or how competitive were they, and how much were they doing in terms of pushing you?
Yeah, I mean, my dad used to race when he was younger, so he raced all the way until my sister was born. So I think that that's always been in him. You know, even just small little things, like disciplinary things that we would have done to us, which would be, like, summertime would come around and kids sleep a lot, right? Well, not in our house. Dad would call until we woke up in the morning. It'd be 8 o'clock in the morning, and he would call until we picked up the phone. And he'd say, get up, don't waste your day. And so that's just the kind of parenting they had. And while we were pretty spoiled kids, he also had pretty high, you know, my mom and dad had pretty high expectations and a lot of rules for us. So I think there's a lot of little things that they did along the way to make us earn it and learn discipline and learn how to work hard. So definitely working hard was something that they modeled as well. I remember being a kid, and my sister and I would be hanging out at my parents' shop, where they were glazers, so they installed like commercial glass into buildings, and they'd be working till 2 o'clock in the morning on cutting and fabbing things. And my sister and I would have our sleeping bags, and we would fall asleep on, it was like a very big industrial building. And so they built an office in, but of course, since there's so much height in these big buildings, the office had what we called a loft above it. It was just wood paneling, and we would hang out on top of that, and no railings or anything. I feel like nowadays if someone saw that, they'd think that that was irresponsible. Then, you know, let's face it, kids barely get to ride their bike around the neighborhood anymore just for fear of everything. So, yeah, we just hung out in the loft, and my parents would work and work for hours and hours and hours. And, in fact, the reason why we started racing at all was because my dad went to work before we got up, and he was home after we went to sleep when we were really young. And so there was, you know, just a feeling like we didn't know our dad, and we were, you know, my parents thought it would be good if we had an activity that would bring us all together. And so racing was what it was.
Oh, wow. Okay. So how, it's not, your dad was supportive and it was loving, but your dad was a bit absent just because circumstances necessitated it.
Well, I mean, I started when I was 10 racing, and my sister was 8. So for that, you know, first 10 years, you know, he did work a lot. But I have to say that after that point in time, I think that the racing took him away from work quite a bit. He would drive all the way through the night, Sunday night after the races, so that he could be to work in the morning on Monday. So he's still working really hard. But we would leave on Friday, and then we'd leave Thursday, and then we'd leave Wednesday, and then gone for a whole week sometimes. So in the end, it did take him away from his work, but it never stopped how hard he worked to make up for it and to still make ends meet and still be able to pay for the things that need to be paid for and still have the kind of lifestyle that they wanted.
How hard was it for you and the family to decide, okay, Danica's leaving school at 16. We're not going to do schooling anymore. We're going to dedicate ourselves to this as a career.
Well, that was just me. My parents still worked, so at that point in time, that was when it hit home for me that I needed to make it work. I mean, at that point in time, leaving high school my junior year, halfway through the first year. So I went through first semester, which I only was there for 2 months of the 4 first semester of my junior year. I mean, I really felt like, okay, I'm going to really need to make this work now because, you know, society would say that you need to, not only do you need to graduate high school the normal way and not get a GED like I did, but then college and all the other institutions that say that you're prepared for life. So I was fully committed at that point in time. But, you know, it was obviously my parents. I mean, it was much easier for me to make that decision at 16 to be like, hey, yeah, let's quit school. Let's go. How about I move to a whole other country where I can get, you don't even know what I'm up to, and also go do something that I really want to do, which was racing. So for them, I think it was much more difficult to be that parental guidance system that's trying to navigate my life in the right direction. And I guess I remember they said that while it was really hard to have me there, and I think my mom cried most all nights going to bed, it would have been worse if I didn't have the opportunity to go progress my career and just see how far I could take it. So I'm grateful that they allowed me to, instead of placing their own insecurities or their own perspectives or their own fears onto me about, oh, well, what if this doesn't work and what if that doesn't work? It was like they held a really positive space and optimistic space for me to go and see how far it could, how far we could take it.
How did you become that brave that young? How did you become that adult that young?
Let's see, the brave part, I think innocence was bliss at that point in time, and being 16, I was excited to leave school. I mean, what 16-year-old wouldn't want to electively just be able to go do whatever their hobby was and move to another country and not have to go to school anymore? It sounds pretty exciting. So maybe the bravery was a blind spot based on the dream and the goal, and that was to become a professional race car driver. So, you know, you get really brave when you get very singularly focused.
School didn't help that dream in any way.
No, I described it like I was going to my college, which was racing over in Europe and in England and learning how to become an adult as well as learning about cars and all that, which I have to say I learned a lot more about life than I did about cars. So I was at what I called my own college.
I would think that that would be really hard on a number of fronts. It's not just that you're in another country. It's not just that you're 16 years old and, you know, basic adult things might elude you. But now you're entering a world, and I'm not even sure how welcome you are in it. Do people even want to see you racing against men at that point? Like, those things combined would make you grow up fast, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that's very insightful. There was definitely a feeling of, I don't care about you kind of emotions and writing me off as a talent. And then, of course, there was the whole dynamic of being, you know, in your late teens and that transitional time of your life where now I'm being excluded and judged and not included in the fun stuff outside of the car and not treated. And then just dealing with, like, normal teenage stuff, like, you know, guys and insecurities. And, I mean, life was really hard at that point in time. To be 16 and 19 years old by myself without many real friends. And I would say really not really any real friends, because I came back and I remember that I called a lot of the people that I was friends with for, I feel like, 6 months after I'd come back. And after that amount of time, I finally realized I was the only one making the phone calls. And so I stopped calling. And guess what? I never spoke to anyone because they never called me. So there was not ever a friend that stayed a friend from those 3 years that I was there. And that's a long time to come away with nothing, right? To come away with really no education. I didn't learn anything about cars. I definitely didn't come away with any friends, but I gained life experience. So everything I earned was on my own. And at the end of the day, it did help me transition, because that was what proved to Bobby Rahal that I was committed to doing it and that I was dedicated and all in. So in the end, it did pay off in a way, but it was not a lot of fun towards the end, that's for sure.
Greatness can be lonely, the pursuit of it, the obsessive compulsive stuff that comes with it. Are there any regrets along that path, along the relationship path, where you had to become so lopsided because the pursuit of this has to be obsessive that there were things lost in that transaction?
Truly, no. I think that at all, I'm very much a look forward person to a fault as opposed to looking back. So there's nothing I would change. But I can say that when I came back from England after 3 years, because I had not been, you know, treated very well by the people there, and again, no true friendships, and you know, being taken advantage of every direction, it really made me cold. And so when I came back, my parents said that I'm different, and they said that I'm very cold and not very open, and I wasn't me anymore. So, you know, it's always sad when you lose a little piece of you, but I'd like to think that most of that came back. I think that it's okay to be a little guarded on some level and be protective of you and your emotions, but I probably went over a little naive, and so it's okay to take the naive edge off.
Listen and download Danica's Pretty Intense podcast wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Again, this Thursday's guest is Tony Kanaan. So when you say that being treated poorly in England, taken advantage of, what are you talking about there? And how specifically could you look back on it and say, well, there's where I became colder. There's where I became the person that my parents don't recognize it. Or is it just a part of adulthood? It's not necessarily even colder. You just learn from the life experiences, and what they got was a daughter who was more adult.
Yeah, I think some of it is life, but I think building up the armor is part of life. But I think most of it probably came from the fact that I was by myself, that I didn't have someone lobbying on my side to make sure that I was getting the right equipment and the right personnel and, you know, being treated fairly and having them prioritize me as a driver and believe in me. I was really just there on my own, and checks got wired and money got wired, and I stayed on track, and that was kind of about it. But so I think that being taken advantage of from that perspective and really not nurturing me as a driver and building confidence up in me, it really made me feel like I couldn't do it on some level. I remember thinking maybe it's too fast for me and I'm not comfortable, because we went to the fastest track that we would go to was this track called Thruxton, and there was so many fast sweeping corners and I was not good at all. And I remember thinking maybe I just can't do it. Maybe I'm just not confident enough. Then fast forward, coming back to America and having opportunities and being, you know, the first driver to go flat through 3 and 4 at Motegi, the first driver to, you know, to be like flat through turn one at Mid-Ohio and qualifying in the front row, and to be, you know, flat through the, you know, turn three chicane at Sonoma to start on the front row there as well. You know, just, you know, there was a lot of examples, I think, along the way afterwards that made me go, wow, I can't believe I got scarred like that, that I would think that I wasn't confident enough to just go fast, like that was somehow not a talent of mine, or I wasn't brave enough. But then, of course, there was the personal side where it was, you know, dealing with teenage guys being just, you know, and not being on their own and going to hunt girls down and being either taken advantage of or left behind and kind of sitting alone a lot. So that was also part of, I can't imagine that there's pretty much a human out there that didn't experience some of that going to high school, which was the age that I was when I was there. So I had to deal with all that, but all alone without friends. And so, you know, sometimes I would spend hours on the phone with my sister or my mom or my dad on the phone, and that was what I had. But they would stay up really late or get up really early so they could talk to me, because it was about a 7-hour time change. So I just tightened up and created a lot of armor because of those things.
When did the loneliness end?
That's a good question. I mean, when I came back, I realized I really had very much attached myself to this goal and dream of being a lone driver, and anything short of that was a failure, and had told myself that story so many times. And so I remember it was the Formula Ford Festival in 2000. I had left in the beginning of 2001, so it was near the end, which I didn't know was near the end. It was just, that's just how it was timing-wise. And my mom was there, and I remember having so much fun, and I was, like, waving to all of the track, and I was, like, having a good time and hanging out with my mom and friends. And I just remember being really happy, and I had a great weekend. There was a European race as well as the Formula Ford Festival, which there was well over 100 entries for each of those championship series. And I finished top 5 in the European race, and then I finished 2nd in the Pullman Ford Festival, which was the highest for an American, and then the highest for a girl for sure. And so I remember looking at that week and going, when I have fun, I do better. So it made me a lot more at peace coming back, because I realized that, you know what, food in Europe, I love breakfast, and breakfast in Europe is terrible. I don't want to have like a croissant or a ham and cheese in the morning. I want like eggs and bacon and waffles and pancakes and all the good stuff. And not only that, but I want to be at a table with people that care about me and people that are my true friends, and I want to be with my family. And I realized that all of those things made me happy, and happiness and success go together, and I can't be successful without being happy. And so coming home seemed more comfortable for me, because being happy was going to help me accomplish what I wanted, which was just to win and be great.
That's like a spiritual moment of clarity, no? Like, it came to you that way?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I arrived. I mean, I had had so much fun finally in England, and it materialized into a great weekend, and I associated those two things together. But isn't that so true? I mean, when you have fun, you just do better. And that was the epiphany that I finally had. And I was like, let's come home, screw this and screw these people. And it all worked out.
What an amazing thing, though, because really you found joy from like crawling around in the joyless, and you couldn't have success until you had that joy. That's the part of it that sounds a bit spiritual.
Yeah, and also the low, right? So, I mean, I've come to really realize that there's no growth without pain. And so, you know, if you feel discomfort and you feel pain and you feel like you're lost even on some level, sometimes those are the transitional phases that are occurring where you're about to break through. And so I can look back and see that now, but when I was a kid, it just sucked. And so now as an adult, when I'm sitting in these moments where I am uncomfortable, I realize that this is the work. And so I'm able to push through easier.
Wow. So you're that conscious about it, though? Like, you've felt enough discomfort that you can say now, now when the discomfort arrives, oh, look, I can just look at it, and this means that there's a challenge here that's worth tackling.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it might not be my first thought, but it's a soon thought. You know, I mean, I can remember a couple of years ago, even going through the transition in my life at the end of 17 with retiring and having my last full season and, you know, moving and relationship changes and living arrangements. I mean, everything was changing all within days. And the time before that was like, I just wanted to wake up 3 months from now. Like, I just don't want to deal with this. This is the worst. But I also knew that the only way to the other side is through. On a small scale, it's like, remember times when you've been sick and you feel like in the moment you think, it's just death, and I just would do anything to not feel like this anymore, and it's just horrible, and it feels like it just takes forever to feel better, and then all of a sudden you look back and you're like, you can barely remember. I mean, that's how it is, right? You need to have that, a little bit of that perspective that I can only get to the other side by getting through this. You know, the memories aren't nearly as bad as the emotions in the moment, but they're necessary to sort of alchemize your life, make it take new shape in a way that is not the way it currently is. And so I also look at that as far as change goes too, is that change, I look at change similarly probably to most people at the beginning, which is like, oh shoot, I'm not ready for that, or I don't know. But then the next thought that I have is, and some of it's just because I've been forced to have change happen, and then it gets better and you're like, oh wow, I'm so glad that happened. And so then you can kind of develop that thought pattern of, which I have now, which is, change is, yeah, it's like uncomfortable on some level, but what if in the end this could all be better than it is right now, and better than I could even expect it to, right? Because we can only look at a situation and apply what we've seen and learned and heard from to create our expectation level for it. So maybe there's something new on the horizon that you haven't seen or heard or learned, and it's going to make your life so much better and more rich and more fulfilling and happier. But, you know, if you're going to be paralyzed by fear that you want consistency and you want to have an okay life instead of the possibility of a great life, well, you know, that's up to you. But I choose truth, and I choose to take the opportunity and go through a little bit of pain and discomfort so that I can come out the other side in a better place and as a better human being. And we're talking about situations that are, you know, somewhat to do with me and somewhat outside of me of scenarios, but I do this work on a daily basis internally as well, where I realize that if I participate in the same thought patterns or the same activities or put certain things in front of me, whether it be certain social media things or certain television programs or people in my life, I'm going to compromise my ability to be happy and be a better version of myself if I keep doing these things, if I keep telling myself the same story or hanging out with the same person or, you know, going about these certain routine activities that you do that maybe aren't necessarily adding to your life. They might be reducing it, in fact. And I just want to grow. I mean, like, that's literally it's my word of the year. So, which I have done for about 5 years now. And so, you know, grow is the word, and something doesn't help me grow into a, you know, better version of myself, then it's something that needs to be evaluated and you got to move on from, even though there's discomfort there.
I've got a number of follow-ups, but when you say word of the year, your fifth word of the year, what does that mean?
Just for every year, me and my friends, after I moved away from Arizona, my girlfriends and I would take trips every year so that we could spend some time together, some more time. And on these trips, we kind of grew in lots of ways, but one of the things that we started doing was, as a group, we started coming up with our word of the year. And so that's been going on for about 5 years.
So can you help me understand, because when you say you come to realize growth without pain is not possible, is there a point where you came to realize that? Because I imagine you're taking all of this stuff with you, Danica, to the Dalai Lama with Aaron, right? That you're You're seeking something outside the mind. You're seeking to be the person who observe your thoughts instead of being your thoughts. So I got to imagine that's part of the quest, no?
Self-awareness is underrated and underdeveloped as a society, as being aware of your thoughts and where they're coming from, and how, you know, the things that you have had either happen to you in your life, past traumas, relationships, business situations, whatever it may be, is molding your perception on a situation, or your, there's always a backstory to maybe why you treat people a certain way or react to certain things because, you know, you've been wounded in some ways. And so understanding where your thoughts are coming from and where those patterns and those thought processes were developed, it helps you get to the root of it and pull it out. And basically the goal is to get to the place where you're just not offended by anything, right? I mean, I still totally get offended by things, and then I have to check myself. And sometimes I'm able to get over things completely and not let them be a part of my reality because they're nothing to do with me, and that people project onto you certain insecurities about themselves and they can feel hurtful. But understanding that the things that are outside of you are not to do with you. But I still do it too. I mean, I still take things personally. And, you know, if we can all just get to the point where we don't take things personally anymore, I think there would be a whole different society, a whole different, you know, world, culture, all over the place.
If not all that, what is it that Aaron loves the most about you? What would he say he loves the most about you? Because I would imagine that that allows him to do some following, that you could learn together some pretty cool stuff if that's the space you're exploring.
Well, I think that if you once you step into more of your truth of who you are, some things in your life fade away that don't support that, and other things show up, and he showed up. And, you know, we think very similarly, and we have a lot of the same interests. And I would say that on a more of a funny, simple level, he probably loves my cooking. But outside of that, it would be that I'm open-minded and that I'm curious and I like to learn. And that kind of all falls into line about all those things that and perspectives and thoughts that I just mentioned. We are very much on the same page with our interests. And I'm sure that he would say he loves my openness and my readiness to learn.
How did the beginning of the relationship go? If I may get a little personal, if you don't want me to, please tell me to back off. But I am curious how you two meet and how you, because I would imagine that this conversation would be happening over a very long time if the two of you were together, and that would make it instantaneous beyond the physical and the obvious, you know, commonalities of interests.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I met him a very long time ago, and I mean, we both really have remembered that time that we met at the ESPYs back in 2012. You know, I just, we both can sort of say, like, I remember you. I mean, when I would describe it, I said, I don't really remember your face even. I just remember you were funny, and I remember thinking, this is a really cool guy. And anyway, it was a very short conversation, I think, at some after party. He was doing some movie lines, and I was like, I love movie lines. This guy's hilarious. And so, but I remembered the energy of him. So that was the first time we had ever met. And then from there, it was like, obviously, much, much later on when we actually were talking for real and then started spending time together. You spend some time on the phone, and you realize that you have so many of the same interests and so many of the same hopes and dreams and everything from where you want to go to the fact that you want to travel and, you know, all those kind of life goals that you're hoping for. You know, we realized that we were very similar. We realized we were even more similar than we thought. So it just went from there.
And where did you realize that you were more similar than you thought?
Yeah, just from the, like, wants, like traveling and, you know, open-mindedness and things like that. We were like, wow. You know, we're into a lot of the same things and curiosities and interests.
Does it then become easy? Just the relationship, having a relationship easier than it's been in the past, because if you connect on that many levels, and it'd be hard for it to go wrong.
Yeah, I think that it makes it easier to last because you have a good foundation. I feel like we talked about this, like in a relationship, there's three kinds. There's the kind of relationship where you grow apart. There's the kind of relationship where one grows and the other doesn't. And then there's the kind of relationship where you grow together. And so I feel like we're in a relationship where we grow together.
Yeah, that's the coolest. That's where the best stuff resides. Where did your confidence start then? Because you were talking before about doubt, where not as it relates to the relationship, but racing and when you were lost and before you found the link between joy and success. Where and when did confidence start replacing doubt?
Slowly but surely, once I came back from England, we were talking about words of the year, and a couple of years ago, one of my words was confidence, because I felt like I needed more of it. You know, in this wide world of judgment and being graded every weekend, you know, there's a lot of opportunity. Shoot, graded every lap. I mean, every 20, 30, 40, 50 seconds, I had a result that I was being judged on. So I feel like for me, in the moment, sometimes it was hard to be confident, but when I looked at the full scope of life and where I've been and what I've done, you know, it was easier to bring it back to a place that felt more confident. But I would say that it's been a slow process. I would say that I'm a methodical person in general, and I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm overly confident with too much. Other than my cooking and working out, I feel pretty strongly about those, but, other than that, you know, I realize that, you know, it's a process and you can always grow and do better and that there's, you know, there's a lot of talented people out there. So I think that it's been just a growing process since I came back. And I can't say that I was super duper confident on the way out. Like, I just think that confidence is something that I feel like, especially if you're challenging yourself. I mean, if you're pushing to new levels and you're trying new things all the time, which is, again, that discomfort and that space there is how you grow. You're going to find yourself butting up against being a little insecure every now and again, more often than if you just stay in your safe space. So for me, the fact that I don't feel like I'm overly confident also tells me that I'm willing to challenge myself.
Again, listen and download Danica's Pretty Intense podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This Thursday's guest is Tony Kanaan. I could talk to you for a lot longer, but we're going to let you go. Just one last question.
Well, I know how you feel.
One last question before you go. We'll do it again because I do find some of the stuff you're talking about interesting in ways that transcend sports that, you know, people need to hear a little bit so that they can go searching or break out of some of their patterns. But when you and Aaron Rodgers go out, who drives?
Oh, he drives most of the time. Yeah. Yeah, we usually drive our own cars, and if we're going out, he's a gentleman and he drives.
And the mustache, he told us you were not a fan. The mustache, he said, not she.
Oh,
is
no. Well, he, you know, it's not his best look, but it's a strong mustache. I'm like, if you're going to have one, it's a good one. But I told him, like, you keep the stash all year if you want. I don't really care. It's up to you. It's your face. But, I mean, your best look isn't that. And I think he is well aware of that. But he's a big fan of costumes. I'm sure you've seen that, you know, with the Canadian tuxedo this year. And so I think that mustache is a little like a costume.
But Danica, I don't understand. He's impossibly handsome. Like, what is he doing?
I know. That's the problem, is that he goes and puts a Canadian tuxedo on, and, like, you're like, but damn, you look good. It's just like an odd outfit, but you look really good, and it kind of works, but he's impossibly handsome with a mustache. He's impossibly handsome with the Canadian tuxedo. He's handsome with a beanie on and a beard, but, you know, he's handsome inside and out. So
I love him more than you do. I love him more than you do. I'm jealous of your relationship with him. There, I said it. Danica, thank you. I did enjoy that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Take care.
I found her super interesting. Next week, we've got someone else interesting for you. I'll tell you about that in a second. But check out Lebatard and Friends, the network. Check out the merch store that we have, lebatardaf.shop. We appreciate all of you supporting what we do. And next week on South Beach Sessions, we will ask Washington State coach Mike Leach whether he's ever seen a ghost.